2 Samuel chapter number 15 is where we are at as we continue on our series, Grace Through Weakness. 2 Samuel 15. Tonight's a little bit of a letdown. There's no snacks on the stage, so that's already a letdown for some of you here tonight. So 2 Samuel chapter number 15 is where we are going to be at tonight. I hope it is an encouragement and a help. We look at a passage that's difficult tonight as I think about this. I want you, as we read the passage, to think about somebody who's been in a position of leadership before and what it means, somebody who is a parent, what it means, somebody who's been displaced before by the choices of someone else. And I want you to walk through the passage tonight, trying to think through and understand what it had to be like for David and those with David as they went forward. 2 Samuel 15. Remember last week we talked, and we'll talk about this in a second here, we just talked about the coup led by his son Absalom. And we're going back and finish chapter 15 tonight talking about comfort for the hurting. Comfort for the hurting. I want you to see here in 2 Samuel chapter 15 and verse number 13. Let's pick it up there in our account. "And there came a messenger to David saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom.'" Doesn't mean after as in pursuing in the sense of with vindictive attitudes or motives. It just means that they're following. They're all about it. They are 100% in. They're allegiant to. So they are after, they are allegiant to, they're following Absalom. "And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, 'Arise and let us," what's the word there? Flee. "Let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring," what's the word there? Evil. Now, we're going through the passage. Think about it as somebody who has led others. Think about it as somebody who has had other people dependent upon him. Think about this as a father or somebody who's ever had a relationship broken. He is having to say, we have to flee because Absalom will bring evil upon us. And not only that, note what he says at the end of verse 14. "And smite Jerusalem with the edge of the sword. And the king's servants said unto the king, 'Behold, thy servants are ready to do whatsoever my lord the king shall appoint.' And the king went forth, and all his household after him. And the king left 10 women, which were concubines, to keep the house. And the king went forth, and all the people after him, and tarried in a place that was far off. And all his servants passed on beside him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men which came after him from Gath, passed on before the king." That's important. They are not Israelites. That'll make more sense to us later, perhaps. Verse 19. "Then said the king to Attai the Gittite, 'Wherefore goest thou with us? Return to thy place and abide with the king, for thou art a stranger and also an exile. Whereas thou camest but yesterday, shall I this day make thee go up and down with us? Seeing I go whither I may, return thou. Take back thy brethren, mercy and truth be with thee.' And Attai answered the king and said, 'As the Lord liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will thy servant be.' And David said to Attai, 'Go and pass over.' And Attai the Gittite passed over, and all his men, and all the little ones that were with him. And the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. The king himself passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness." This is on the east side of Jerusalem. They're passing through this valley Kidron. It's going up like towards Gethsemane or the Mount of Olives, as it would be. "And to Zadok also, and all the Levites were with him, bearing the ark of the covenant of God. And there set down the ark of the covenant, and Abiathar went up until all the people had done passing out of the city. And the king said unto Zadok, 'Carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord God, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. But if God thus say, I have no delight in thee, behold, here I am. Let God do to me as seemeth good to him.' The king said also unto Zadok the priest, 'Art not thou a seer? Return to the city in peace, and her two sons with you, Ahimaaz, thy son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will tarry in the plain of the wilderness until there come word from you to certify me. Zadok, therefore, and Abiathar carried the ark again to Jerusalem, and they tarried there. And David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olivet and wept as he went up. He had his head covered, and he went barefoot. And all the people that were with him covered every man his head, and they went up weeping as they went up. And one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And it came to pass, when David was come to the top of the mount, where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head. Unto whom David said, If thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. But if thou return to the city and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hither thereto, so will I now also be thy servant. Then thou mayest for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And hast thou not there been with Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, therefore, it shall be that when whosoever thou shalt hear out of the king's house, thou shalt tell it to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. And behold, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them ye shall send unto me everything that ye can hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came unto the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Tonight, we want to talk about this passage and think through it again as David as a leader, as a father, as somebody who has these relationships, and see how his life is fracturing before his very eyes. When I think about this passage, we're going to walk through the hurt, but implicit in the passage, I think you'll see the care and comfort of God for him as he's hurting and for those around him as they are hurting as well. I read the account recorded by Robert Louis Stevenson. And he told of a ship that was caught in a storm off of a rocky coast. It seemed like they were going to be driven against the rocks to their destruction. And so they had everybody down in the hold there to try to minimize any kind of loss of life or casualty. But he records that one man broke a protocol, popped out to see what was taking place there in the pilot's nest. And he went out, and as he's looking through the storm and trying to catch a glimpse through the lantern and a flash of lightning, finally he saw the man who was holding the wheel and just ever so easily trying to get them back on course. And Robert Louis Stevenson said, the man said he watched the man for a bit, worried to see if he would have any kind of sign of fear or anger or anguish on his face. But he said the man looked down at him, gave him a little grin, nodded, and he popped back down. And here's what Louis Stevenson recorded. He said, this man went down. When he went up scared, he came back confident. He said, I've seen the face of the pilot. He's smiling. All is well. And Stevenson said that reminded him of so many difficult times in our life where we may not know what's taking place, but you can look ahead with some level of confidence that all is well. I would just step back further than Mr. Stevenson and say, there are times in our life filled with hurt, frustration, a lack of clarity, confusion shrouding our present and the foreseeable future. And I would say we have to step back, yes, acknowledge the emotions, yes, acknowledge the difficulties, yes, acknowledge all the frustrations we currently face. But realize even in the midst of that, God has not forsaken or abandoned us. You can have a level of comfort even though there's not an elimination or alleviation of those things because all is still well in the hand of the captain of your soul. We come to our passage tonight and we remember what's taking place. We've just watched David's family just melt down and fracture. We know it all started with him, his choices with Bathsheba and Uriah and Ahithophel. It continued on, unfortunately, with Amnon, his treatment of Tamar, David's inactivity about that, his passivity about that, and Absalom's frustration about that, and then his passivity, and then his revenge, and then David's outrage about Absalom and Absalom's exile, and then he's welcomed back because Joab gets him to come back, and David says, you can come back, but but you can't see me. And so there's this in-country exile. And so there's just all this drama. And so he had been exiled for 3 years, kind of like we showed on the map of the last time. He'd been exiled out. He's come back. And now as he is set there in the nation of Israel, nothing has gotten better. Absalom's heart has only soured to the point where we saw last week, as a narcissist, he invokes this rebellion or this coup against his father, against the nation. And he did it very, very secretly. He kept putting himself in positions to make judgments he wasn't qualified or called to make, to have influence he wasn't deemed to have. And so he just kept drawing a following, drawing a crowd, and he feigned spirituality and care for them to the point finally, as a narcissist, he pulls all those people in tactfully, but he does it to their own hurt ultimately. Tonight we pick up and we find a grieving father and a fallen leader finding comfort from God in what might be one of the lowest times of his life. This nomadic situation is different. This exile's different. He's run from Saul for a lot of his life before, hadn't he? He'd known the difficulty and frustration of feeling abandoned by God at certain times, of feeling like God's promises weren't coming to pass. And those were in his younger years. But now in his older years, those should be done. But now he's on the run from his own son. As we walk through this passage tonight, I want you to consider this reality. It's on the screen. In times of hardship and grief, regardless of why we have them, God is faithful and he grants comfort. I want you to hear that again. He's faithful and he grants comfort. Well, but I won't deserve it because I made my own mess. God is gracious, faithful, and comforting when we've made our own mess, haven't we? He's gracious, faithful, and comforting when it's something we haven't done of our own and it's been foisted upon us by something or someone else. So as we walk through this passage tonight, consider David the fallen leader and David the grieving father and how God implicitly comforts and guides and directs David. First thought tonight is this. David is reminded of the consequences of his sin and it's seen by how he elects to leave Jerusalem. David is again as a nomad of a result of what? His past sin and his poor responses to God and his poor responses to man. But catch this, even in that, God does not abandon him. Now, we read verses 13 and 14. You may not say, hey, those immediately scream God's comforting and caring for him. But you'll see by the end of the passage, as we've already read, that's certainly where David's at in his heart, even in the midst of grieving. In verse 13, God allows a messenger to arrive. In their time and culture, he would have had the responsibility to deliver news civilly, good or bad. So this emissary arrives to David. And what's the news according to him in verse number 13? Hey, there's a coup. It's not whispered. It's happening. It's not just happening. They're on the move here. It's not being planned. It's not being discussed. If we don't leave now, we're going to be overtaken by Absalom, and he's got the whole nation backing him. We are in a perilous situation. The message is here. The majority of the nation are following Absalom, and they have seemingly forgotten David. Now, I want you to pause and consider the frustration or pain that had to be there for David. What do you mean, Pastor? I mean this. Who has been the champion of Israel's history up until this time? David. I mean, Goliath was only the beginning of how God used David through the nation of Israel's life, right? As the anointed king, a man not after the heart of the people, but a man after God's own heart. But the majority of people seem to have forgotten that now. Who was the anointed one by their last prophet, Samuel? It wasn't Saul, and it's not Absalom. Who is it? It's David. But they seem to not care or remember that. Who cared for the ark? Who got it back? Who messed up and still tried to get it right? Who's made sacrifice? Who's made preparations? It's been David, not Absalom. Who's been a national treasure for Hebrew music to this point? Absalom or David? David. And the news comes that the people's memories are more interested in what have you done for us lately, therefore heeding the overtures of Absalom rather than what David has been used by God to do. Now, it would be one thing if this was done by a total stranger or by somebody who had constantly or consistently targeted him, an outsider, somebody that David knew, the enemy he could see, the enemy he could recognize. But that's not the case. It's his own flesh and blood. It's his son. His adult son has this level of anger, bitterness, hatred, and animosity. Now, I get it. He's in this position. We remember it. He's in this position because of his choices and the choices he put other people in upsetting positions. Bathsheba, Uriah, Joab, Ahithophel, Tamar, Absalom, his wives, David's wives, their mothers, and the nation and Nathan's judgment. We understand David has done this thing. His choices have brought about grief for his wives, his kids, his nieces, his nephews, and the nation at large because of God's intervention upon him. So we understand that. And so this message of the people are with Absalom has to sit very heavy upon him as a leader and as a dad. So David responds to the messenger in verse 14, and he recognizes the seriousness of this matter. In verse 14, catch the urgency here as he says it. In verse 14, David said to all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee." You don't flee if you feel like you got time, right? You don't flee if you feel like there's safety where you're at. You flee when there's something very significant and immediacy is needed due to a threat. Put it yourself there in perspective. Let's say you were at a house in the middle of the night and one of your kids or your loved ones yelled out to you, "Hey, fire!" I mean, what are you doing? You're not like, let me check to see what's on Facebook first. No, you're responding with urgency and immediacy, right? And that's what's going on here. There's an urgency here that David recognized. Why? Because the intentions and motives seem clear to David. What are the intention and motive? Absalom is capable of, and he is willing to do harm to anyone who stands in his way. Catch how he says it here in verse 14. There's evil. He may smite us. It's not a good thing. Did David already know this about his son based on how Absalom had treated others? I would say confidently, yes, he knows that. He was fueled by anger. He was deceptive in his tactics, not only with Amnon, but now about his father. He's cruel in his execution of his plans when he wants something. He was unconcerned with his father's feelings as he felt vindicated due to David's inactivity. David knows full well Absalom is capable of anything, and therefore urgency is needed. Somebody may ask the question here, how did David not realize this was happening? I mean, he's a leader. He's the king. He's got people around him. How does David not know that the coup is forming up? I don't know. I don't know if we can say for certain. Is this a case of he knew and did nothing? Because sometimes that's been his modus operandi, as they say. Or that he was sincerely unaware of what was taking place. Or he felt secure in his position to where, well, even if Absalom tries this, his efforts are going to be unsuccessful with the people. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I just know this. At this stage, it's happening, and David has to respond. He recognizes, I am in the middle of the consequences of my own sin, and we have got to get out of here. Number two tonight, David is reminded, though, of the grace of God by the loyalty of those around him. In verses 16 through 23, we start seeing this loyalty pour forth from his people to him as an imperfect man, but as the Lord's anointed king. You see in verses 15 and 16, the loyalty of his servants in the midst of this urgent and sudden chaos. David doesn't find his people angry at him. He finds them to be incredibly supportive of him. He leaves a certain contingent behind to manage the household. There's different thoughts on this. Why would he leave 10 women there? Is he leaving them defenseless? Does he know what's going to happen? Does he think they'll fare better because they are vulnerable there and that they won't be treated poorly? I don't know that we could know that either. Unfortunately, they are treated poorly long term. But another set of servants pledged their fidelity to him. They could have elected to join the coup. They could have said, we're going to hand you over and hope to salvage our comfortable and familiar life. But instead, what do they say here in verse number 15? The king's servants said unto David, "Behold, thy servants are ready to do whatsoever my lord the king shall appoint." How far are they willing to go for their imperfect anointed king? Whatever you say needs to be done, we're going to make it happen. God indirectly and implicitly comforts David by putting people around him to encourage and help him through the hardest moment, perhaps, of his life. In verses 17 through 22, the scene shifts to David taking a tally of all who's with him. So they're exiting Jerusalem east. They're going through the Kidron Valley up to the Mount of Olivet. And at that point, when they feel they're far enough away to be able to spot and see anything on the horizon, they start tallying who's with them so they can form up in a military structure and provide safety and stability and security. So they start traveling out. You'll see it on the map here. They start traveling east, northeast from Jerusalem there. And you see him ending up out there in the wilderness north of the Dead Sea quite a ways and south of the Lake of Galilee. David has this happen because he's largely responsible for them. Because now what are they? They're not seen as fellow citizens. They're seen as felons, as fugitives to the new regime. And so he has to have a level of understanding about who's with them and how they can be cared for as they go forward. So who are these people? Well, in verse 18, there's a group of dedicated soldiers that would act almost like David's royal guard. We've seen them before alongside of David's mighty men. There's all those different ites that are there in verse number, 18 and 19. And you have them surrounding David and going before David with their families, and they're his honor guard. They're his bodyguards, if you want to say it that way. And then we're introduced to somebody really unique, Ittai the Gittite. He's there with David, and this passage talks about him and some other ones too. It's a man who is a leader of a group of Philistine forces. Who are the Philistines? Israel's sworn enemy. But while David was hiding from Saul and in the land of the Philistines, these men joined David as a leader, and they apparently not only joined up to David as a leader. Here in our passage, we see this. They didn't only join up to David, they assimilated in to the nation of Israel. I'm just going to give you a real quick timeout, side note, caveat. It would do us as Americans a lot of good, as Christians in America, a lot of good, to go back and read the Old Testament and how they treated the foreigner and the stranger in their land. Everybody's like, don't get political about it. Every aspect of our life is subject to principle and practice and example in the scripture. I would encourage you sometime to go back and see God's policies about people. You know why? Because it would help us with humanity with laws rather than just the coldness of laws and forgetting people's humanity along the way. Ittai the Gittite here has assimilated in as a foreign pagan into the nation of Israel, has been key to David in many successes, and now is David's bodyguard as well, and he's there. But I want you to see what happens. David expresses some concern for them and their well-being, and maybe even, I don't know, possibly himself, by stating to them, maybe you should stay. You know, you don't have skin in the game, as it were. You followed me, you've been gracious to me, but being a foreigner, as he calls them, being an exile from the nation of Philistine, you could probably stay and Absalom's going to give you a pass. Or you could try to go back home even. Either way, what does he say? Mercy and truth be on you. I love you. I've been thankful for you. But this isn't your fight. You don't have to do this. I don't know, maybe David was concerned they'd swap sides. That happens sometimes in the bits of a rebellion or a coup, making David's issues worse. Perhaps they would fare better with Absalom as foreigners rather than fugitives, like we already said. But I want you to catch verse 21. I want you to put yourself in their scene and think about David. Is he hurting? Well, yeah, we know. We've read the passage. He's hurting. Is he grieving? Yes, he is. And hear from the mouth of somebody who grew up in Philistine areas, in Philistine religion, what they say, and as we read it, I want you to transport back to another story similar to this in the Old Testament and see who you can come up with that parallels or reminds you of it. Look at verse 21. What does he say here, Ittai? He says, and Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely, in what place my lord is the king shall be, whether in death or in life, even there also will thy servant be. Now, I want you to sit there. Pause for a second. this man and his group responds by pledging their fidelity both not only to Yahweh, the God of Israel, but also to David, the anointed king. I like the way one author said it. He helped us think about who else echoed such a statement. Has anybody put the connection together? Who does he sound an awful lot like? Ruth? Yeah. What does Ruth say to Naomi? Naomi says, go back home, go to your people, go to your gods, go back. And what does she say? Where you go, I'm going. Where your God is, I'll be there. Who your God is, I'm following, I'm serving. Here, a tithe, the Gittite, is used by God to do what? Hey, this may be where we're at right now, but we're with you. We're with you. We believe in God, our God. The foreigner saying this, our God, to care for us. I believe that God will care for you, our king, and we're ready to serve you as well. Look at verse 23. They're all going out, this group. People who have left Jerusalem with them. People who didn't have to stay with them. And they're all going out there. And in verse number 23, what's going on here? They go out here, and all the country wept with a loud voice. They're weeping together in solitude, showing their mourning over the sin of the present. But I do want you to catch this. I think it bears keeping in mind. They are noting the sin of the present, the rebellion, the coup. But they aren't hurling accusations about the issues of the past. God, in his comfort and his care, has surrounded David with people to help and encourage him in his distress in the present rather than beat him up about the choices of the past that, yes, seem to have led to their present. One author said it like this: David was a king without a capital city, but he was not without supportive citizens. All the nation may be following Absalom, but God had people there to help, comfort, and even protect David as he went through this dark time in his life. Third thought tonight, David commits his future to God's care rather than trust in symbols of God's care. I might even put there in quotes, superstitiously. Is he leaving Jerusalem? Has he left? Yes. Has God surrounded him with people to encourage him? Yes. But then he goes forward here and commits his future to God. Look at verse 24, what he says here. Zadok also and all the Levites which were with him bearing the ark of the covenant of God that set down the ark of God and Abiathar went up unto all the people that had done passing on in the day. What did we read and seen here in 24 and 25? The priests bring out the ark of God and they, as the priests, come forward to David, the anointed king. And so they're showing there the ark of God and the priest of God. And they're showing there as the covenant people their affirmation of God's true king. The ark and the priesthood are symbols of the presence of God and symbols of the pathway of reconciliation back to God. So a symbol of presence and the pathway of reconciliation. And so what they're trying to do here is show those who are with Absalom, hey, God's not with you. God's with our anointed king, David. God's presence will not be for Absalom and will not bless Absalom in his coup and his rebellion. It's with David. It's for David and not Absalom. Now, David could have received this. He could have said, that's absolutely right. You better be with me. Absolutely. But instead, you see the opposite. David rejects this type of talisman approach to having the ark and the priests. I love his heart as demonstrated in verse 26. What does he say? He expressed his confidence in God's ability to curtail this uprising and allow him to go back to the holy city. Look at 25 with me, or 26 rather. Yeah, 25. He says, carry back the ark of God in the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, what does it say? He will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. What's David saying here? Listen, I can't control the present. I don't know to a certainty what's going to happen in the future, but I'm going to commit my care to God and his care for me in the future. And if it be that in his desire, in his wisdom, in his holy purview, he says it's right and appropriate for me to be restored back to Jerusalem, then here's what's going to happen. I'm going to get to see the ark, and I'm going to get to go back to the holy city, Jerusalem, and I will be restored. Just because he has been dethroned does not mean he wants God, quote, dethroned from his earthly throne in Jerusalem. He wants it to remain there, and if God desires him to go back, that's what's going to happen. But I want you to catch this. He also realizes, you know what, I'm a frail man, and maybe I don't know exactly what's happening here. In verse 26, what kind of attitude does he have? One of like, you better believe God's going to vindicate me and take me back to Jerusalem. He says what in verse 26? But it may be, if he has no delight for me, then he can do what he seems right to him. I will trust God's righteous judgment upon me, however that seems to fall out upon me or upon Absalom. But I will not take the ark and the priest and act like, see, I got these. I'm good now. I was right. He says, no, go back to where they should be, Jerusalem, and God will take care of me in the way he deems appropriate and right. I trust him with my future. Verses 27 through 29, David knows the special ministry and usage of Zadok and his sons there, their priest. He knows that they will go back there, and what they'll be able to do is gain vital intelligence information for him as well. And so in verses 27 through 29, he says, not only should you guys stay there, but I need you to be there. I need you to be some help for me. In verse 27, he tells them, you're a seer. Go back to the city. I'll wait in the plain. Verse number 28, you come back and tell me what you're hearing. He said, you all go back where you're supposed to be, gather whatever intel you can, and bring it back my way so I can know, have some information, and make some decisions. He's kind of sending back, as we'll see even more in a second, some spies to help him. They need to do what God wants them to do in Jerusalem. They're also going to help the anointed king, not by running around with him in the wilderness as a nomad with the ark, but by being where they should and passing along what they hear. So David says, I'll trust God with my future. Lastly tonight, David trusts God to bring the uprising to an eventual end. And verse number 30, see what takes place. David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olivet and wept as he went up and had his head covered, and he went barefoot, and all the people that were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. The scene is difficult. If you've ever been in a situation due to a loss, suffering, or death, and you know what it is to have nothing really else to do except to weep, that's where they're at here. They're mourning the displacement from the holy city and the normal activity of getting to worship their God. They're broken and they are lamenting the sin of Absalom and the nation's foolish trust of him. And so they're symbolizing their grief the only way they know how. Sometimes words aren't enough, as it were, right? They're weeping. Their feet are bare. They're covering their heads. Later, you see somebody put dirt on just to show their lament, the outward sign of the level of grief and heaviness they are experiencing. And here's what I want you to see. God does not remove any of it. He doesn't swoop in and say, yeah, it's all right, guys. I got this thing. Nah, you know what? Absalom's going to die of a heart attack on the way right into Jerusalem. All solved, all done. God doesn't swoop in to remove it, but he does not abandon them during it either. Friends, so much we'll say here in a second about that, but in the middle of our hurt, in the middle of our discomfort, in the middle of our loss, in the middle of our pain, sometimes we wish God would just take it away, but that's not his goal. His goal is to be our sustainment through it. His goal is to grow our dependency on him through it. And he graciously takes our grief, and that while it remains, also intersects his comfort. And you have this almost dichotomous two-way feeling of I have heavy grief, but I also have intense and greater than grief comfort. And it's like they are cohabitating rather than one just being there and the other disappearing. How do we know they have such confidence in God, though the plans of man seem stacked against them? Because of how they respond and react. Look at verse 31. When David is informed that Ahithophel's treasonous actions have taken place, he's joined sides. What does David do in verse 31? He prays what we would call an imprecatory prayer, a prayer asking God to intervene and bring justice and righteousness and judgment. Now, catch this. David doesn't pray this prayer out of pettiness or vindictiveness, but he prays it because of the unrighteous choices of Ahithophel that he's made. David is expressing his confidence in God to do what? To overthrow or to undo what Ahithophel, who should be a rock solid top advisor to Absalom, he's asking God to turn all that upside down and make it seem as if he had no idea what he was talking about, as if all his counsel would seem appealing but end up being foolish and come to naught and make it distrustworthy overall. That's David's prayer for Ahithophel. Side note, maybe we as Christians in either the workforce or in our relationships or even with our politicians could learn from that. Praying not for fire to fall on people like some misguided apostles, but for God to do his work in undoing the unrighteous intents of others around us for our harm, for the spiritual malignment of God. In verses 32 through 37, another loyal servant seeks to serve the king in this midst of this unrighteous coup and show his side he's on. His name's Hushai. David realizes his greater service to him is to do what? Not come out and help him, but to do what? Go back. Hushai, Zadok, all of them are to go back and do what? Undermine the counsel of Ahithophel. Work in concert together. Hushai is to go back there and speak against Ahithophel. He can form this network with Zadok, Abiathar, Ahimaaz, and Jonathan to inform him of what's being plotted and what's taking place in this coup. And they're going to work in concert against what Ahithophel's trying to do to the harm and hurt of David and bring about God's righteous end to this rebellion. And verse 37 gives us the picture of such a trusted friend. We have one man, Ittai, sounding a lot like Ruth to Naomi. Now I want you to catch the heart and item there in verse 37. Somebody said it earlier, right? I want you to see verse 37 and see the echo there. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Look back at verse 36. Behold, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them you shall send to me everything that you can hear. Who's this remind us of? If Ittai's reminding us of Ruth and Naomi, we have now Hushai, and what's he reminding us? He's reminding us of Jonathan when David was on the run as a nomad the first time, right? Who was his inside man? Well, the king's own son. And now, against his own son, the king's son, he has his trusted friend, Hushai. He's there willing to hazard his own well-being for the betterment of God's purpose through the truly anointed king. Now, David does not know how this will all end. He can't read the tea leaves. He can't read a fortune. He can't see the future. But he trusts God's plan for the kingdom, trusts God's plan for himself, and trust what he already knows about the plan of Messiah that must and will come to pass. Maybe we could say it like this. David knows this. Absalom's rebellion will merely be a footnote on the pages of Israeli history rather than a lengthy chapter. Why? Because he can trust God with what is taking place. This is a sad section of David's life. And we could rightly say it's due to the choices of the past. The lack of righteous responses from him throughout the various moments with Bathsheba, Uriah, Nathan, Amnon, Tamar, Absalom, and Ahithophel have created heaviness for countless others in the kingdom besides his house. Other households are affected and impacted because of him. That said, Absalom's sin generated this ugliness. Though partially culpable, David is not abandoned by God. Consider this as we close it out. God is gracious to grant David deliverance from the unexpected rebellion. He gets to head us up and he gets to head out of Jerusalem. God is gracious to grant him supporters and encouragement from their support, though it's to their own peril. God is gracious to have taught David that he is faithful and able and trustworthy with the future. He's taught him it about that in the past. He's teaching him afresh in the current. God uses the time here to assure David of his goodness. How do we know that, Pastor? How do we know that this coup and rebellion by somebody he has love for at some level who has betrayed him, that this is all used by God to help teach him about the goodness of God? Well, give me this. David possibly pens at least these three psalms during this time. Psalm 3, Psalm 27, and Psalm 63. During this exile, we think he pens at least those three Psalms, 3, 27, and 67. So as we end the message tonight, I want you to think about this. You're sitting here saying, Pastor, God comforts us even in the times where he doesn't take anything away from us that's causing the discomfort. So what good is it to go through those times? Look at Psalm 3 with me, would you, as we close. Psalm 3. David is a nomad in his older age. And God is teaching him that even in times of hardship and grief, regardless of why we have them, God is faithful and grants comfort. Look at Psalm 3. Let's read it aloud together. I'll begin us there. Psalm 3 and what we call verse 1. Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are them that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God, Selah. Now, you're supposed to pause there, right? Because this is to music. And Selah was for them to pause and think about what was just said. People are saying this, God, that I have no future. So what did he grow about? What did he learn? What did he come to rely upon in his faith about God in verse 3? Let's see it there. Let's all read aloud together in verse 3. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory, and the lifter up of mine head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill, Selah. What's he saying here? When I had nobody backing me on the majority, and people said, there's no future, I cried to you, you heard me, you acted on my behalf. And catch what he says, you did it out of what? Your holy habitation, Jerusalem. I'm displaced, but nobody displaces you from your rule and your reign and your ability. Verse 5, I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people. We could insert there, running around with my son in this rebellion, that have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord. Save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all my enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people, Selah. What's he saying here? In the midst of this nomadic issue that I'm facing, yes, because of my sins of the past, but yes, because of the sins of someone else in the present, you never abandoned me. You walked with me every step through my hardship and my grief, and you were faithful, and you granted me comfort. You heard me. You were a shield. I never once was out of your care. My friends, tonight, I don't know the hurt, the frustration, the discomfort, in the present, from the past, even if you feel like it's your own doing and your own fault. I don't know. I don't know what you're facing in an uncertain future, and I can't know, and I can't change it, and I know you know that. It feels so out of our hands sometimes, but we've never traveled so far by our own choices or the choices of others foisted upon us that God's unable to care for us or that he won't be faithful to us. Not because of our merit, but because of his character and his kindness. Tonight, whatever you're going through in your hurt, whatever you're going through in your frustration, whatever you're going through in your discouragement, you're not the first of God's people. You won't be the last. And God has been faithful for every single one. Tonight, I hope you could look at David's heart and David's life and the grief and see that God doesn't take it out, doesn't remove it, but he moves in alongside it and goes through it with him. And he'd do the same for you. And maybe this week, you need to just take some time and read Psalm 3 and Psalm 27 and Psalm 63 and be reminded somebody walked this same path as me as a human being, and here's what God did and taught him. So tonight, however you're hurting, I would remind you there is comfort in the midst of suffering, and it does come from our great God because he is a comforter of the hurting. We would know in the New Testament he's our great priest who's touched with the feelings of our infirmities. So let's go to him tonight. I'm going to pray, and let's take a moment for reflection. And maybe tonight you're hurting, or maybe tonight you know somebody who's hurting and you want to just take a moment to pray with them. Let's take some time for that. As I pray, if you want to go pray with somebody, just get right up and do it. You're going to be all right to do that. Father, would you give us grace tonight, myself included, to remember you comfort the hurting. And often we think, well, but I kind of did this to myself. I don't deserve any help. No, you're a gracious God and merciful God, and you still help us. You still comfort us. Sometimes it's the choices and ugliness of others that are creating the hardship and frustration for us, and you're still faithful then as well. God, I pray that you'd help us tonight, each one of us, that we would not only seek your help in distressing times and find your comfort, that we'd seek out others and have our hearts tender and our will ready to respond to the promptings and nudging of your Spirit to seek out those who are struggling and be that witness of your comfort if they are not your followers, or the encouragement to them if they are your followers. God, help us when we're David, but help us to be a Hushai as well. Help us to be a Zadok and Abiathar as well. Help us to be an Ittai as well. So we ask for your help in this, in Christ's name. Amen.